Just for your future interest, Susan, I want you to know that a refill at Adeline's is 20
about art,
because we're in the coffee shop, and like we're doing art in this coffee shop, supposedly, or we're having an interview or whatever, and I vacillate myself, but I shouldn't be answering because I'm the interviewer, so tell me what you think about art, darling.
I like when you answer, because then you give me ideas and answers, especially. Well, you know, there's this new magazine out called Soma.
Yes.
It's South of Market.
Yes, it's quite nice. Magazine.
And one of their opening features was about this question of what is art. And they had all these different people in different mediums answer. And I can't remember any one answer in particular, but the gist of it was living on the edge. And I kind of like that. I think that, I mean, you know, art is some people making something so that ultimately you'll sell it and buy donuts like these. But
with donuts like these, we don't need a lot of money. Just the type of art artist I am.
These, we don't need art. Look at this. This is so beautiful. It has this really nice, round, hard, crusty shell and a hole in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's a plain kind of cake, cakey, old-fashioned donut. It is a good one.
Well, the fact that your show's at 3 a.m. and that I was up most of last night trying to finish a piece for it made me feel like I'm in sort of the right frame of mood to be talking at 3 a.m.
I'm very flattered, you know? I feel like it's 3 a.m. anyway. The days seem to be merging. I got up at about 5:45 to go to yoga this morning. And I've been at work a half hour, and now I'm here. So, God, what a wild, wonderful, wacky life I lead. No,
you're pretty cool. Well, you made me think of this last thing I heard before I turned off the radio last night and started working.
What was that?
It said, if these were Star Wars, you'd be the black hole. I had to think about it for a while. But
so is that all you're going to say about art? That's
art's
on the edge?
Art's a black hole. No, that's a tough one to answer, because I still waver between thinking of myself as an artist and thinking of myself as a recording engineer. I mean, half the times when I turn on the buttons, I'm more worried about the technical quality than the concept, and then I have to go back and forget how it sounds and think about what it says. And so I'm listening to it with a schizophrenic pair of ears, which is no different than how anybody evaluates their own work. You know, how are the colors and what do the colors do in the end? But
the technique is part of it as much as the concept.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, because you do work on commissions and you do work that is, you have this wonderful blend, I think, that you do these things that are interviews, supposedly, and then you start putting, quote, I hate to keep using the word art, but you keep putting art into it. You have effects, and you have little things in the background, like in Dark Madonna, for one thing, which could have been just a straight-ahead set of interviews. All you really had to do, at the least, was really record very well these fascinating accounts by different women. But no.
So
no, it's so effective what you've done.
Well, I think you're helping me make an answer here. Art is slippery. Art is the gray area between the story and the technology that goes into it. I think that's such a difficult question. What is art? I mean, art has price tags. Art has, it changes with the place in which you find it, you know? I mean, some people sort of figure that art is hanging on a wall. I find that the area in which I work is the most loosely categorized when it comes to really defining art, because it's all based on sound. And for me, art is mood. I really like creating a mood.
Uh-huh.
Suzanne Lacy's asked me to do, gosh, I like sitting this close, it keeps us in stereo, right? Suzanne Lacy's asked me over the past 3 years to do a number of installations based on mostly feminist themes, women and aging, women who are minorities, of minority races living in Los Angeles, portraits of women from different cultural perspectives and economic backgrounds. And in taking all these hours of interviews that I'll do for her in different recording sessions, I try to go home with all the pieces of all the facts and create almost a fictional quality, so that you have less of a hard documentary journalistic story and more of a portrait, more of a mood about what they're living inside of instead of just what they look like.
That's what I was trying to say in my perfunctory way. before, you really do achieve that. You know, it's quite wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So is the next, is accusation like that too? Or is accusation,
well,
for Suzanne as well?
In a way, accusation is coming from a lot of the unresolved moods that I tried to introduce into the Suzanne Lacy pieces, two of which I've given you tonight to play. One is Dark Madonna, and one is... No, actually, I've only brought one. I did another one called The Whisper Project about women and aging, but the Dark Madonna piece, which we can talk about later, is about the minority... the different women, female minorities living in Los Angeles. But out of all those pieces I've done for her in trying to create moods and characters whose stories come out of the facts about their lives, I ended up wanting to create this piece called Accusation, which is the portrait of a woman who is living in this precarious balance between fact and fiction. How much of what she's going through is imagined by her and how much of it is in fact what people see her doing. It's the life of a woman as seen through a bedroom window.
This is Accusation?
This is Accusation. Some of her neighbors see her through a bedroom window, and others see her on the street or in the pool house where they swim. She lives in a small community. It's actually based in Paris, although not obviously so, although there's some of the hints of that.
Is it fiction, or is it based on people that you know, or
it's
composite?
Actually a weave of fact and fiction, which was an intent in trying to create the world of a woman who is living in this mental imbalance between what she imagines her life to be like and what her life is really like. I tried to create that by adding a twist. I interviewed people about women they know who had particular obsessions or fantasies, or who had either contemplated suicide or some kind of escapes from life, either just vacation escapes or real departures, I mean, mm-hmm. plotted, mm-hmm. you know, suicides. And I took all these interviews and wove them together with the narration that I wrote, which is performed here beautifully by Leticia de Compiègne and Sheila Davies. And in the end, tried to create the mind of the woman in question, who is ultimately a victim in this piece. Her voice is that of Sheila Davies, this conscience in the background. And one of the principal witnesses, which is Leticia, who is giving almost a newscast, a blow-by-blow account on this woman as well, which is in French and English. And the other people who have watched this woman on the streets and through her bedroom window, which is what is on a courtyard that they share with her, because their apartments are also on this courtyard. They are the testimony woven in between it. So it's a piece about fact and fiction and the real and the imagined. And it's a landscape of sounds through which this woman has moved, and the sounds give you clues as to where she lived her life.
Well, this is a perfect spot to play this piece, I'll tell you. I'm sure that some of my departures have, you know, a lot of my little trips and holidays and have been, I think if I hadn't done them, I would have kicked the bucket or something. No kidding. I think it's important to depart, get away, fantasize.
Yeah, well,
I think it's necessary for life.
That's a piece about escape. I mean, that's why I wanted to include a lot of people knocking on the door of this woman's mind as analogies and accusation. And there's a question of whether she's locked in or they're locked out. People are trying to get in and figure out her story, and she's trying to get out and tell it, and she's just mm-hmm. a victim of her own consequences. You know, you did a piece I love called My Pleasure. Just get a Barbie plug in here. And I love your swimming sequence, and I was always haunted by the beauty of the pool water. And then recently I saw the movie Children of a Lesser God, and I was so...
Oh, I still haven't seen that. I hear it's great.
The play was wonderful, but the movie is so sensitive too, and there are these scenes of the woman swimming, the woman who is deaf, and the scenes are perfectly quiet, and she's cutting through the water in this blue light, mm-hmm. kind of like a blue pool light. And there was no sound in those scenes, and I was so struck by what it's like when you're underwater, when you can hear, and then the fact that she couldn't. And that muffled quality of the swimming is what inspired me a lot in some of the sound sequences of Accusation.
David Hollinger did the sound on that swimming segment. And what he did was he had a great mic. I don't know whether it was a boom mic or what.
In your piece?
Yeah. But he had it on a fishing pole, on a huge pole, just suspended right in front of my mouth. And he walked along the pool as I swam. And then we just picked a very small part of me swimming and breathing fairly heavily. And then we kept using that as a loop.
Oh,
and I liked
nice.
It a lot.
I'd like
to do more with it.
I didn't get very close to my swimmer, but there was one man who was doing the butterfly in the pool, and it created this incredibly powerful rhythm, which is part of the climax in Accusation, this boom, boom, boom rhythm, which I tried to blend with the knocking on the door, trying to get into this woman's mind, and of course the swimming is her swimming and fighting these terrible dreams she has about drowning, which may or may not have actually happened to her.
How did you augment the sound of the butterfly thing, like technically? What did you do?
Well, I ran it through an equalizer, and as I boosted the volume in this one sequence to build a climax, I rolled off the high end so that it got more and more resonant and bassy, so that the swimming became less water and more hard knocks against the surface.
I noticed it, especially in Dark Madonna, but lots of other, almost all of your works, that as you said, deals a lot with women and women's psyches and their specific places, problems, and so on. And I wondered, as I said, especially in Dark Madonna, has this, all this work changed your own consciousness about being and about things in general? You know, because your pieces are all very, very thoughtful. And I remember a really early one. Remember the pineapple boats from House of the beginning sketches of House of the View and House of the View, and they're so wonderful. So, where did your consciousness sort of get twisted around or changed, or has it always been like that, or what? Because you know, you must have, you know, you're classically really, as I wrote up in the folio, people have been commenting, you know, I said the classic wasp, and it's not a put down. I mean, she's just gorgeous with this wavy, long, blonde hair. It's how I always wanted to look my whole life, you know,
Jesus,
tall, blonde woman. So, obviously, in high school or even earlier, you were always had to be praised and singled out because you were so perfect looking. It's the ideal American girl, woman, you know. So what happened to get you brainy and thoughtful and conscious and, you know, so unself-conscious about yourself and your looks?
We only have 45 minutes? Oh, that's quite
Bob,
good.
Bob, actually, when you ask a question like that, you just go, oh, boy.
Oh, girl.
Oh, God.
Oh, God. Well, I had some pretty, and sure, everything comes back to one's parents.
In other words, you're so pretty, how come you're smart? No, that's a joke. That's a throwaway cheap laugh, yes. You know, to get her to laugh.
It was a cheap laugh. It was very cheap.
Thank you.
A cheap comment. You know, I had parents who were not given to a great deal of honesty, and the only thing they really wanted was for their children, all five of us, to wake up every morning and say, have a nice day, and mean it. And so most of us spent a lot of time being pretty locked up, and I found myself thinking when I started doing these pieces and wondering why I hadn't started sooner or why I was starting at all, and why they were taking the shape they were taking, because they're kind of bleak sometimes. I could only compare them to how people get when they finally have the perfect moment to sit down and write someone a long, really honest letter.
Mm-hmm.
If the mood is right, if the hour is right,
that is
and
the
you
feeling
have the time.
From your work.
Yeah, well, that's nice, because that's sort of the only way I can compare it to my, you know, to sort of unwrapping all the thoughts that spend a lot of time being under the Have a Nice Day number. My parents didn't want to ever know what we really thought about anything. I used to be asked in the morning by my father, what are you going to do today? And then at the end of the day, ask me what I had done that day. And if I told him the truth, which usually didn't amount to much, he would say, surely you can do better than that. And so I said, okay, listen to this, you know, and then I'd come out with this story.
And you'd make stuff up?
Oh, sure. Oh. And he loved it. And
what would you make up?
Well, you know, I'd usually capitalize on my academic performance, which is where you get the pretty and smart bit, because if you fell for it, he did too. It's not all there.
Oh, come on. So, but, what had you actually done?
Just, you spend a lot of time kind of locked up and thinking about what you would like to have said, but the fact that you didn't have the audience kept it from being said, or without having the encouragement kept it from being said. So you spend a lot of time mulling things over, thinking to yourself, and constantly composing letters to the imaginary person mm-hmm. about the real story.
Mm-hmm.
And the pieces have really felt to me like letters to someone very dear and very unquestioning about the real story. And the characters are often taken from family members. Accusation has a lot of my mom in it. She's very locked up, and she hasn't heard it before. I think it would make her sad. And that makes me sad a little bit, but it's the truth. What she would hear, I think, would strike her as being fairly accurate portrayals of parts of her life. But I think that the stories just simply come from a long desire to get things out. And in the telling of these stories, the embellishment and the sound effects and the environments I'm trying to create on tape are part of the real story, but easily elaborated upon because they've been kept quiet a long time from events in my life. And now that I have more courage and more distance from those stories and periods of my life, it's easier to let them go.
When you were doing Dark Madonna, were you surprised by some of the stories? Were you moved? Were you shocked? I mean, did you cry? How did you feel about doing that, about recording some of those things?
That was a really hard piece. That piece destroyed me.
So I found even listening, I was sort of weeping at times. I was very moved by it, you know?
One of the criticisms I had about Dark Madonna was that it was a piece, an installation in Los Angeles in 1985. I'm sorry, it was 1986. It was just last year, last May. And the women who were involved in coordinating it, administering it, pulling off the press releases, were all by and large white. And I thought, how can we honkies really have a part in this? An accurate part in portraying this minority portrait of Los Angeles, given our backgrounds. And here I was, living at home with hours and hours of tape from Chicana, Latina, black, Chinese women, and making choices about what stayed and what went in terms of what would create the impact of the Dark Madonna, which again is a mythological theme based on religion, but association with a religious figure in different, throughout religion, and how these women related to it. I won't get into that point right now. And I sat there listening to these stories and going, my God, you know, I have no right to be in this. This is really beyond much of my experience. All I can do is care an awful lot, and I really did.
Mm-hmm. That's all you can do. You can't become black or Chinese, you know, so you have to make the best of it.
But I was a wreck by the time it was done. And the first draft went down to L.A., and many of the principal speakers in the piece listened to it, and some of them felt that the stories were too abbreviated, and others felt they were too long, and the others felt they were too dramatic because I'd left everything in. And they made some good criticisms. But I was constantly beset with the dilemma of how to represent a story that I'd never lived, and yet it was my job. And I was really drained by that piece, and I couldn't do something like that again for a while because it took an awful lot out of me.
Why do you use voice all the time? I do too. It's not a criticism. I'm infatuated with it, but why do you use voice? Well, I'm infatuated.
Well, you know, when you asked me a little about myself before this interview, I was tempted to bring along a resume, and I looked over the first line, and it kind of reads like what my goals in life are. And
what are your goals in life?
Well, that's...
We won't forget what goals
I'd like to leave that one alone for a minute.
Okay.
But the opening line had to do with how the human voice, to me, felt like a compositional instrument, because with a razor blade in the editing room, you can chop it up and do all kinds of things with the parts of speech that can enhance moods and change characters and make points of speech more absurd, whatever. And it becomes a game, a musical possibility in terms of how you change inflections and delivery by rearranging parts of speech. And the voice just interested me a lot like that. I was first interested in it because my first recording assignment when I was taking a broadcast engineering course in New York years ago was to go out and get an interview with a native New Yorker. And most of the native New Yorkers had been in, that I met, if you put native in quotes, had been in New York a month longer than me and had come from an island, most of them. And the one in particular was my neighbor, who was a gypsy cab driver, which meant, you know, he was Puerto Rican, but he drove a cab that was not part of the standard yellow cab fleet, so they called them gypsy cabs. And he drove around, and he had all these Jesus and Mary medals clinking away on his dashboard, and I kept sticking the interview up to his mouth as we drove around New York and said, well, tell me more about your life, and why did you come here, and all this, and he just laughed. And he told me really crazy jokes, and I could never understand them because his accent was thick, and he was laughing, and the medals were clanging against the dashboard. And when I came home, all I had was this hour-long cassette of laughter.
Oh.
And so I just cut the laughters together, and I took it into my course, my class that night. And the teacher said, well, what's this? What am I supposed to do with this? And I said, well, this is the character that I brought you. And
wonderful.
And that was sort of the introduction
to
a
composer. A composer is born.
No. I would say that if there was a grade for composition, I would not have considered myself a composer that day. But
well, one of my first pieces, Final Spin, one of my first tape collages, has a laugh right through. It was an actual argument I was having with someone, and he had a very distinctive laugh, and it was all being taped. So we used that. That's, you know, the take your hands off me business and relax. No, I am relaxed. Well, the laugh is right through. There's a laugh track. All put together. I agree. I mean, every piece I do has voice in it too. I'm enthralled and infatuated and in love with voice, either in terms of speech or song or anything. I think it's the best instrument in the whole wide world. I really do. And that's why I like your pieces, actually. That's why I'm so biased, you know, in liking them too.
Well, there's an evolution that goes on. In the very beginning, I liked playing with cut-up voices and rearranging, you know, the words.
Yeah.
But now I'm more interested in what the story is in
uh-huh.
the end. So
uh-huh.
I keep a lot of the speech and interview and actuality and raw material intact. And I leave the editing process mm-hmm. pretty much alone and try and just deal with the story and see what I can do to enhance it. And usually it doesn't need a thing, it just needs to be told.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit more the direction I'm going in now.
Tell me about Anna.
Anna.
Anna. Tell the people who Anna is. Mm.
Anna is my favorite palindrome.
That's
Anna's,
right.
Anna's
she
my
sure
little
is a
girl.
Little palindrome.
Yeah.
And a pal.
She's a pal. Anna's a year and a half old, and she's on tape. I've been recording her since she was 2 weeks old.
Uh-huh.
And she's great. Yesterday she got up on my chair and started playing with the faders on my mixer and laughing wildly, so I figured that either she has no respect for my work, which is probably better, or would like to take over, which is even better.
A budding assistant.
Yeah.
So you were saying that, I didn't know what donut I wanted, so I pointed. I had no idea what the name was, and that's what you do in a country where you don't speak the language. And Susan said, that's what Anna does all the time. She just points, and just, what did she say?
Well, she just points, and my husband and I figure that Anna's completely fluent. We just don't know what language she's speaking.
But she seems to get the point across.
She gets the point across with her little finger.
Well, you know that this story of one of my friends, his father was a really well-known Canadian poet, and his name was Coleman, and Coleman was three and still wouldn't talk, and would just point and go, you know, and stuff like that. And then he was four, and still wouldn't talk. So his mother took him to the doctor, and the doctor said, "You're just making it too easy on him. Don't get him anything. Don't give in to the pointing and the, you know, these gestures and stuff." So she brought him home, and finally starts pointing to something and whining, you know, not saying anything, and she's just ignoring him. And this goes on for a while, and the kid is screaming, and she said, "If you want something, ask for it." And he said, "I want a glass of water, and I want it now."
Did he really? He was four when he said this, the first sentence? The
guy's great. God, now he's probably drinking Stoli.
Oh, he's a gourmet cook and an architect and, you know, stuff like that. Vastly overweight. Very nice. So, has it changed your life? What's it like having a baby?
I don't sleep very much.
Anna was wired to a monitor for what? How long?
That was tough. She was born with this breathing irregularity, they call it, sleep apnea, and they link it to crib death. So we were pretty haunted for the first 6 months of her life because she was wired to this little monitor, and every time it went off, it sounded like a microwave going off when your food's ready. I remember once she wasn't even with me, and I was sitting in a bar or cafe something,
and
somebody's microwave went off, and I almost fell off the stool, and my heart raced, and I looked to the person I was sitting with, and I said, "I have to go home." "Why?" I have to go home.
Yeah.
And I ran home, and she was fine. She wasn't even on the monitor at that point, but the beep was too real to be forgotten.
But you didn't? Wouldn't you go away on a trip, the three of you, and then forget
monitor?
The batteries or something?
That only happened once.
That was unbelievable.
We stayed up all night just trying to stay awake.
But
and
look,
make sure
it passed. It passed, and you got over it. What was it, 6 months?
You know, it's amazing how capable you are of forgetting pain. I mean, I'm sure that's why people go on to have second children. But not even just speaking about childbirth, I thought I would not get through those first 6 months with her on the monitor. It would go off 3 and 4 times a day, and every time I had to act like this is the real signal. She's now quit breathing, and I have to give her CPR. And she was fine. She made it through. And now I think she'll outlive me for sure. And I'm glad.
Now she's always walking around with a book, and she wants you to read to her. She's so great.
She likes the red balloon book now.
What's all that?
Well, you asked me what books mean to me.
Yes.
What books?
Oh, I'm so happy because I forgot about that.
No, well,
I did. On the phone, I asked Susan talk about books, because books are very important.
I have a couple of chief inspirations. Some of them are people I already know, and what I wonder about them is what either they're not telling me, so I make it up on tape. Try and create live stories for
Isn't
them.
Isn't that fun? I don't like a lot of the porn books, so I just, you know, sometimes write my own.
There you go. You see, if you can't get it between the sheets or between the pages, you make it up.
No, I don't make it up.
You get it between the sheets then.
Then I write about it. It's about, you know, a day a year, but it's pretty exotic. Okay, well, what's that?
Well, if I...
Are you going to read or what?
No, but my inspirations are these people.
Oh.
And the other inspiration are books. I really have been drawn to a couple of books in the last few years that gave me great food for thought. They just told stories that set my mind racing about stories that I wanted to tell also, or stories that I was guessing about that other people, you know, were more involved in their life stories. And so I started thinking about, some of the books that I keep near me all the time that if I pick up and read remind me of places and time that just, I don't know, give me my own escape.
What are some of the books you keep near you?
Well, the first time that a book gave me structural inspiration for a piece was when Suzanne Lacy asked me to do a piece in 1983 called The Whisper Project. And the end result title was Whisper the Wind, the Waves. And it was about women over 65 who were aging and talking about death and life and the loss of love and the loss of beauty. And it was an installation in La Jolla, California. It took place, it was broadcast through
16 speakers on a cliffside, and down below there were 160 women in white over 65 years of age sitting at tables. They were talking about aspects of aging, but their pre-recorded comments were coming out in a collage through the speakers around the edge of the cliff. And Esther Broner, an author from New York, had been part of this project, and her book, A Weave of Women, was a great inspiration in terms of creating the collage, because her portrait of women living in Israel in the 60s, I believe it was, just was so moving, and the different characters that came through, it made me realize that I shouldn't just cut up these women's dialogues for the tape collage, but try and preserve something of the character so that as you heard a woman's voice, you stayed with her throughout this hour-long collage. Mm-hmm. You kept hearing her come back. You got more and more of the picture about her life. And there was the last chapter, in the last chapter from Esther Broner's book, there was a paragraph that I loved, and I kind of hung on to it. Not that it figured that much into the whisper piece, but I will read it to you.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't bring the book, but I wrote it.
Good.
Dahlia has made a record, Lament, it's called. Dahlia will make a little money. She'll still have to grab for jobs, and she worries about her throat and about aging. But her throat will warble in the city and in the desert, and her skin, with regular visits to the bathhouse, will be lineless for years. The candles burn to stubs and the bonfires to embers. Night. There is no heat and it's chilly. And that's an excerpt from the last chapter of Esther Broner's Weave of Women.
But she's a good writer.
She is a good writer.
Yeah.
And her characters, although they disappear for chapters and chapters, would come back with more impact because you'd missed them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they came back, they had a little more to give you. And so you, you know, you had a sense of time, timelessness, because they kept, and you could count on them reappearing.
Have you met her?
Yes, I like her a lot.
Oh, you met her, that's right.
Yeah, we were pretty involved in the Whisper Project together. Mm-hmm. And she was a real anger for me, because I was so overworked. It was my first installation of this size, and Suzanne and I were doing all of our coordination by phone.
Yeah,
and
the first time is
easy.
always different.
You know, first time's hard.
Read some more.
Well, the other books that and writers who have meant so much to me, Paul Bowles wrote a book called Up Above the World, and he had a wonderful prophetic line in it that was spoken by one of his characters, and the character said, as he looked out from his balcony across this jungle landscape where he lived in some obscure Central American city, he says to his two American hosts, who he's invited to dinner in this beautiful retreat, as they're looking out, it's not exactly what you think. And nobody knows what he means by that. But they're about to embark on this twisted journey as the guest of this man, and they cannot leave his clutches or his house. And it ends up being this really twisted, tortuous maze of human relationships. And I loved the fact that I didn't always know what was going on, but somehow it didn't matter, because the story was so compelling that you wanted to stick it out and just keep trying to find clues. It was so mysterious. I don't know, maybe it was the heat he kept describing that made me want to stick through it, because I remember reading it in the fog and I really wished I'd been in the heat. But Paul Bowles and Milan Kundera, whose books also haunt me, the characters are so impossible and so sad and so enchanting. These have been really inspirational. And I've wondered why I'm more drawn to people who seem to be impossible and fictive than people who are real when I'm reading books. I don't know, maybe it's because I don't think I'll ever really meet them, so I'm able to get closer more quickly with less to lose. I don't know.
Again, they're more on the edge, therefore more interesting. They're more elusive. You really don't want to normally read about the commonplace. Although I do sometimes. That's why I like reading Chekhov and some Virginia Woolf. And I want to know what people have eaten, what their food is like. And I hate it when an author just says she prepared a light lunch. I want to know what was in that light lunch, you know. Very down to her tactile, but I do like.
You must like Joan Collins, because she's the only actress that eats on TV. Did you know that?
Oh, listen, I had a fight with my boyfriend. He was late, and I decided, don't rant and rave. So I put on these gorgeous see-through pajamas, and just as he walked in the door, I was putting, and I had nice makeup on, and I was just putting an orange segment between my lips. And I just sort of looked at him and said, well, that was about it. And that was pretty devastating.
What did you do with the orange?
Oh, I ate it. I was putting it between my lips, but I just sort of was very haughty. And I just modeled myself entirely on Joan Collins. And guess what? It really, really worked.
Orange slices, huh?
Orange slices and see-through black pajamas.
Oh, that's gotta help.
You know, let's stop this for a second. Not the tape. No, no, not the tape. But the books, the books. I saw you twice. This is so weird. I saw you at the John Cage signing. You know, the book signing, the guests come in to supper. Guests go in to supper. If I ever say that right on the air, it'll be a miracle. That Burning Books book. And John Cage was there at City Lights, and I saw you there. And then you were at one of my parties, at the party we had for Kenneth, actually. And you were earnestly talking to Michael Sumner. And both times I saw you, welcomed you, was thrilled you were there, and we never talked. Do you realize that? And then you left. You left early in both cases, let's say. And I noted, did you know that I noted you were there and was happy to see you and beaming across, but we didn't connect. Isn't that weird?
I think
it's interesting.
But you know,
I mean, it's fine.
No,
I'm
but
not
I feel
even
comfortable with that because you're the kind of person I know I'm going to see again. Sometimes I feel like when I go to a place like that, when I see someone and that's the only time I'll ever see them, I hook in, but
well, I feel safe, you know, but it was strange.
You looked really pretty. You were
when? At John Cage?
Yeah,
thanks.
You were really pretty. It was sunny afternoon.
Mickey Mouse t-shirt that Letitia and Maggie gave me for my birthday. Yeah, and I wore it for John Cage.
Did he like it?
He liked it. We had a very good conversation. We have a couple of friends in common, believe it or not.
Mickey Mouse?
Mickey Mouse and a couple other, Toyoshi Tomita and John Siddall and a few other people.
There was this wonderful man walking around City Lights that day, and he was shaking, and he was really gray. And he
I saw him.
Did you see him?
With a little button. I think he had a button, you know, some kind of, yeah.
Melody Sumner went up to him, and she said, are you here to see John? You know, she's the great hostess, and he looked around and he said, John, who?
Right, I like that. Right, so, read more quotes, because then I want to ask you more stuff, if you want to.
No,
I'd like to hear. Are you?
I think that it's a hard thing to talk about books and inspiration, because what I'm kind of bugged by is the fact that I'm drawn to books filled with impossible characters that lead these really almost magical lives. You know, things happen to them that may or may not happen in real life, but certainly they happen in foreign places, and you feel like with the distance and the geography between you and that setting, it's more of your imagination can come into play and you can get more out of it because you're putting more into it with the writing helping you. And I'm so drawn to those characters that I wonder why I then go back and want to base my pieces on real people. And why I'm not more inspired to create completely fictitious people as well.
Oh, because real people are the most fascinating. I've discovered that. And most of the fiction that you read, I see Anne Beattie's name there.
Well, yeah,
most of the fiction that you read is based on, who do you think it's based on? Most of it is not made up.
Well,
there's nothing strange, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. Well, it is. Read the bloody newspaper and hear the news. It is so amazingly wild. You couldn't make up most of the stories that are, you know, that you hear as true.
But Kundera did. You know, I think a lot of those people are made
up. How do you know?
I don't. But see,
Melody does. So she seems to make up a lot, but then she doesn't. So much of what Melody Sumner, a friend of ours, much of what she does is based on people. Then she makes up and weaves in these elements. And I'm sure.
Well, then that's why I'm thinking
of
Anne Beattie, because when I read her book Falling in Place, I was so disgusted with the people. No, I was disgusted with the people because I thought, my God,
they were banal.
They were very real.
Uh-huh.
And so I felt like I wanted to be distanced. But then with Kundera, I don't know if they're real or not, but I want to get close.
Well, because you know why the MBD people seem real to you? Because you know, probably you know half them. I mean, she's a similar class and a similar person, probably. She's probably fairly close to your lifestyle, so of course you know those people. So, you know, it's your daily bread and butter. You know, it's your friends. To a certain extent. Mm-hmm. To a certain extent. But,
so I guess I'm living in the balance between what I want to imagine and what's real.
Describe your life to me.
Don't you clip your nails on my donut. These are good donuts. I should finish this one. But you want me to talk some more. My life?
No, you can eat if you want.
Oh, God.
You can just chomp away. Yeah, tell me about your life in 2 sentences.
Well, today it feels very short.
You mean like your span is going to be short?
I was up most of the night. And so this morning it feels short because last night was so long.
You were working on your piece?
Mm-hmm.
See, I envy that. I haven't worked that way for a long, long time. Mm. I've been kind of lazy and kind of hibernating.
You have your equipment in your house, in your apartment.
No, I have nothing. And that's what it's starting to kill me. But I've moved and my apartment is empty and I feel it's empty for a reason. It's empty waiting for equipment. I just have no money.
Isn't it empty so you can rest?
That too. Someone was asking me why my house is so empty, and I said, because it is so restful and so reposeful. Can't tell you. How are we doing on the tape?
Oh, we've got a few more minutes.
A few more scintillating minutes. I wanted you to, were you going to say something earth-shattering? Because I wanted you to describe your favorite day. I ask everybody that. Every single person I ever interview, what's your favorite day? Wake up and you have total choice. What do you do?
Thursday. I like Thursdays.
Okay, why?
I like Thursday. Why? I like Thursdays because the weekend hasn't started, so there's no problem yet with finding out that what you hope will happen won't. You can still hope. And the week is almost over, so whatever has happened is behind you.
Uh-huh.
And usually there was less hope in that part of
it. And what occurs on one of your favorite days?
Oh, it's gray. It's rainy. I can remember dreading sunny mornings.
Can you read this paper here?
No.
Is that your paper?
No.
Oh. There's some good reviews in there this morning.
Reviews of what?
Oh, that there's a piece, Mabu Mines' piece, Cold Harbor, at Theater Arto.
Oh, yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah?
Got a good review, too.
I'll have to check it out.
I like it when it's gray in the morning because I can remember all those mornings when my father would say, get up, it's beautiful outside,
I have
go
heard
do
that.
Something.
That's right.
And the relief of a gray day
That's
means
right.
that you have an excuse not to do anything.
Exactly.
Very,
you know, my mother used to say, the sun is shining, you can't waste it indoors, because did you grow up on the East Coast then?
In the South, on the East.
Oh, because, you know, it's so often gray in the East, so when it's sunny, my mother would say, get outside, it's a gorgeous day, yeah. Whereas I wanted to read. So what I did was read outside, read a book outside.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, she'd say, get outside. I'd take my book outside.
Well, was reading considered a good pastime by your
family? Oh, yeah. Was it considered a good pastime by yours?
A valid pastime. Well, my father was a tree farmer. He still is. And
what kind of trees?
Pines.
Christmas trees?
Some Christmas trees. And that's actually his principal crop now, but pine trees in the past. He had a tree farm and there was some foresting in North Carolina.
Ah.
And he usually liked us to go out with him to the tree farm on Saturdays instead of staying at home and reading.
Uh-huh.
And one Christmas he gave there were only 4 children at the time, and he gave us all little hatchets. And he had somebody burn our initials into the leather handle. And my mother kept walking around and going, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. We're all going to die. He's given the children hatchets. And after breakfast on Christmas Day, I think I was 10, we went out to the tree farm and we cleared land. We chopped little limbs off the pine trees so that you could see through the acre of pine trees.
Did you like doing that?
Well, I thought it was very strange. I mean, most of my friends were going down to the park and eat, and I was going out and clearing land. I just thought that was strange. But there were a lot of things you didn't question because you figured this is your lot, and so you were just going to use your hatchet.
Okay, it's gray. It's your favorite day. It's a Thursday, and it's a gray day. Then what? What do you eat?
I buried my hatchet.
You buried your hatchet? What do you eat? What's your, one of your favorite things that you would eat?
Oh, God. Cream of wheat.
Yeah. A woman of simple taste.
And lots of cream. Not much wheat.
Champagne?
Usually a Coke mid-morning. Coke is good.
Yeah, I knew I liked you when there was a lot of Coca-Cola in your house and a little bit of junk food. I mean, plus all the other good stuff. You know, I like a blend, personally. You know.
I like roasted peppers, and so at lunch I'll put them on some bread with melted cheese. And
red ones?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the afternoon, if I'm home working, I do something that I like to create Reese's cups on a spoon. I take a big spoonful of almond butter or peanut butter and I dip it in this jar of chocolate chips.
You do?
And I eat
really?
It. And I kind of look over my shoulder, but nobody's ever watching.
How come you're thin?
Because I don't eat better than that.
That's what you eat.
Mm. And I don't eat much more than that. I'm not that thin.
What's your next thing you want to do? What's the next, like, big project you want to do, or do you want to do anything, or do you want to rest, or what?
Well, since finishing Accusation, I don't feel like I have a personal project on tape that's pressing. My next job, my next big tape project that isn't really all mine, is another piece for Suzanne Lacy in Minneapolis in February. There's a huge indoor atrium called the Crystal Court in downtown Minneapolis, and I'm supposed to put a sound installation in there for her. The theme is about women and aging again, and I'm getting old thinking of what I can bring to this piece, which I haven't brought to it before, so I'm a little nervous.
I'm sure you have a whole new range.
The piece before was the same theme, but in a different town, so I'm supposed to bring new things to it based on new women being part of it, but I'm a little concerned about the lifeblood I have left. What kind of blood can you wring from a stone?
Really? I use that expression a lot. I'm always trying to get blood out of stones, I think.